Auditioning for the Role of Myself, James Tate Hill on Voice, Disability, and Disembodiment in Blind Man's Bluff, by Audrey Jennifer Smith. The following conversation was recorded on a humid morning in mid-July 2023, among the wooden bookshelves and overstuffed couches of Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. It was at Scuppernong that I first met James Tate Hill in the summer of 2021, shortly after the release of Blind Man's Bluff, JT's memoir of losing his sight after being diagnosed with Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy at age 16, and the attempts he made in the decades that followed to both hide and come to terms with his disability. Blind Man's Bluff is narrated in a voice that's humorous and self-effacing. No doubt the reason why New York Times critic Dwight Garner praised JT as one of the most thoroughly normal guys he's ever encountered in memoir. Hill's wit and sardonic humor are also showcased in his first book, Academy Gothic, a blend of academic satire and hard-boiled noir that won the 2015 Nielsen Literary Prize for a first novel, and reportedly compelled novelist Michael Parker to use the word uproarious for the first time in his life. But the impact of Blind Man's Bluff is much deeper than the wit and charm of its narrative voice. The memoir is also rich with reflections on the experience of living with a disability, incisive critiques of ableism, and the journey from self-denial to self-acceptance, a powerful arc also evident in Hill's numerous essays and in his audiobook column for Literary Hub. I met JT a few months after I'd been diagnosed with a chronic illness that led me to seek disability accommodations from my graduate program, and that ultimately made audiobooks much more accessible to me than print ones. Later, while working as a producer for North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, I reached out to JT about being a guest on the radio show and podcast Embodied. The resulting conversation, in an episode titled Glam Canes and Blind Pride, Disrupting Stereotypes About Vision Loss, remains among my favorites from my time at the station, in no small part because of the way it challenged me to unpack various misconceptions I'd learned as a sighted person, like the notion that reading with my ears was in any way a cause for shame. Another of the guests on that episode was M. Leona Godin, a friend and colleague of JT's, and the author of Their Plant Eyes, A Cultural and Personal History of Blindness, whose name and work are referenced at several points throughout this interview. Two additional notes on content. This conversation includes a mention of the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned race-conscious college and university admissions, which was made approximately 2 weeks before our interview, as well as to the social media platform X, which would still be known as Twitter for a few more weeks. The interview opens with a self-description, also called an accessibility check or self-describe, which is the practice of naming a few aspects of one's own identity in order to make this context accessible without visual cues. Content has been edited lightly for clarity and length, and for those who prefer to read this conversation with their eyes, a print version is available in the latest edition of the North Carolina Literary Review.
I am a white male with brown hair that is too long in places and not long enough in others, and 3 days of stubble, a gray t-shirt, jeans, and discarded pastry wrappers in front of me on the table.
Thank you for said pastries. I appreciate it. I am a white, fat, femme-presenting human with brown hair in a top knot, purple-rimmed glasses. I have silver rhombus hoop earrings on.
Hat tip to working the word rhombus into the introduction.
Thank you. I guess where I want to start is, so for a long time, you really resisted the idea of writing about your own experience with disability. And started exploring this possibility by writing Academy Gothic, which of course features a legally blind protagonist. I'm curious about how you decided to write from Tate's perspective and what writing from like a fictional perspective kind of opened up for you.
Yeah, I had started Academy Gothic just from a generic point of view. That was so much of my early fiction was just generic point of view. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a ton of Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and trying to capture the tone of hard-boiled noir, which has that sardonic edge, also is kind of a self-deprecating edge, and that was what I found as appealing as the plots. I felt like I sort of mimicked Raymond Chandler sufficiently, but I was like, where do I go with this? It doesn't feel like a book yet. And it was actually at the AWP conference in 2011, when the keynote speaker was Jhumpa Lahiri. And there was a point in this keynote when she started talking about her earliest writing days as a grad student of literature and realizing she had given up creative writing, which she had always enjoyed. And every attempt was trying to recapture these middle and upper class white characters that seemed to be the only characters she ever encountered in literature as a student and as a reader, the Edith Whartons and the Henry James. And I think it was one of her readers or professors was like, it's good, it's just missing something. And it never occurred to her, she said, that people might be interested in the specific experience of being an immigrant from India or being a second generation or first generation American with an Indian family and ties to this community. And it's just one of those like gongs being struck in my head, because I had achieved at that point in my life in 2011, which was 3 to 4 years following the divorce that really resulted from self-denial and an inability to come to terms with my disability. So I'd achieved a level of self-acceptance. It was still continuing to expand, but in my head I thought, should I or could I write from the point of view? Would that be the final step of self-acceptance, to write from the point of view of somebody with the blindness that I have? And more than anything, when I got home and started writing, I realized, well, this is the self-deprecating humor I was looking for. If this guy has the same absurd charade of trying to pass for sighted so badly, but also just the plot possibilities of somebody who couldn't see were so much more interesting and so much more book-like, for lack of a better word, or book-worthy than just this generic detective figure. And so I felt like I finally had a character, and it suddenly felt like a book that I should write, not just that I could write.
What ultimately allowed you to move into writing explicitly about your own experience in writing Blind Man's Bluff?
So I was writing essays about Academy Gothic and trying to promote it, and what I found was people are obviously most interested in the parts of novels, for better and worse, that sound true or that are connected to your personal experience. And so I wrote an essay for Lit Hub called On Being a Writer Who Can't Read, and the response was just so overwhelming. I realized I had a trajectory, I had an emotional arc of denial to acceptance, and that was as much of the story and a different story than a horrible dean getting murdered on a bad college campus. And I just realized that this is me. And I think anything we write is us, but also I think we know how to hide the parts of us that we want to hide in fiction and know how to reveal the parts of us that need to be revealed. And I think the best creative nonfiction, we're revealing more than we're hiding.
I love that. And, you know, it made me think about the passages that are in second person in Blind Man's Bluff. And that's a structural decision that you wrote about in another beautiful essay for Brevity, which I absolutely loved. And I'm curious about your decision to include second person. What did that help you access or achieve that you might not have otherwise?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I still think about that from time to time when I'm starting something new and wondering if my default is second person sometimes. Fiction, I don't think I would write in second person, which is why fiction is in some ways an escape for me that I still need. I still need to work in that other genre to take a rest from creative nonfiction. But in so many ways, second person felt more honest. It was me stepping outside myself and me talking to myself in a way that allowed me to make myself the audience. You know, ideally we're putting the audience out of our minds when we're writing, but let's be honest, we never are.
No.
We're always conscious of somebody eventually reading this, even if it's just for, okay, what parts of the story do we need to tell in order for the context to be there and in order for this to make sense. But with second person, I felt like suddenly I was my own audience because I was talking to this other version of myself. Mm. And chiding myself in a playful way and sometimes in a not so playful way. There are these different selves on the page, and the second person really made me feel more like a character in a way that allowed me to distance the past from the present. Mm. Even as I had done that emotionally in my life, on the page, going in past tense, first person, and maybe this is the fiction writer in me, but I was just really trying to inhabit that old time, trying to get back into the setting of time and place without paying as much attention to, you know, what Philip Lope calls the telling, the additional layer of perspective that second person allowed me to slip into immediately. It's weird, I only had 3 chapters in second person, and this is one of those rare things where I think I got it right, at least in my own mind, right away, because I think there are 11 chapters total, and those I always felt an urge to have in second person, and I don't think I could have articulated in 2016 when I was doing the first draft why those 3 chapters were in second person. And later in the drafting, I realized, okay, these are the times that I felt least cognizant of who I was. I felt least able to define myself like the person I thought I was, which is not to say I had any certainty about who I was in the other chapters, but at least I thought I knew, or there was a belief in certainty.
Yeah, and it just, you know, I think a lot of times the criticism of second person is this idea of disembodiment or like distance. And it seems like that distance actually allowed you to embody the story in ways that perhaps, you know, you wouldn't have been able to without it.
Yeah. And the other thing that I found was, I guess I'll say the non-story elements, the sort of self-analysis. I like to revisit those chapters because I think they are more engaging on a voice level, because I didn't have to worry about the storytelling. I didn't have to worry about the narrative, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Because there was so much going on in terms of the engagement with the self and the structure.
Yeah, and so, you know, I want to talk about the voice and the narration here, because we get so many examples of blindness as metaphor, either for ignorance, such as terms like blind faith, or for like an otherworldly superpower, such as in the blind seer archetype that, of course, your friend and colleague M. Leona Godin talks about as the super blind character. I'd love to hear about your experience with these archetypes and also how you sought to interrogate or counter these in writing Blind Man's Bluff.
Yeah. I blamed myself in a lot of early stages post self-acceptance for this charade. Like, I was too weak to own my disability. Mm-hmm. I was too insecure to just be the person that I actually was. But the deeper I got into it, the more I allowed myself to be angry at a society that makes people with disabilities feel less than, that makes us feel like there is something to hide, like there is something. Just yesterday I encountered, it's like, oh, this is a new one, blind luck. Oh, you mean luck.
Right.
You mentioned blind faith. It's like, as opposed to faith, which is the belief in something that cannot be seen or known. And I mean, and that implies that there is no knowledge beyond sight.
Right.
Which is one of the lines I encountered in Rene Descartes in college, of sight being the noblest and most thorough or complete of the senses. And so you encounter those, I mean, what Leona calls ocular centrism. I mean, just 2 weeks ago in the affirmative action decision from the Supreme Court, we're starting to use the word colorblind to talk about affirmative action, and then people are extending that metaphor to the Supreme Court is just blind in general. Are we going to be ableist when we're trying to talk about other marginalized groups? That is not productive. And so I finally reached this point of anger and self-righteousness, which I think is a very productive place to finally reach when you're like, I deserve this. I deserve this anger. I encountered a quotation recently that I really love, which is, anger is the part of yourself that loves you.
Wow.
And the ableism that you're able to call out and recognize as one of the causes for what made you hide. I mean, there were other factors too, you know, just in terms of growing up in an era and area, you know, 1980s Appalachia. We didn't talk about our feelings a lot. There were all these factors that I couldn't recognize as outside myself that would have led me to try and hide something that there's nothing to be ashamed of.
I've kind of noted a shift in some of the conversations around access, around COVID specifically, in terms of, you know, how we're thinking about spaces, how we're thinking about, you know, access in all these ways. I'm curious what your perspective is on kind of the shift or lack thereof in that conversation since the start of the pandemic.
Yeah. You know, and we're in 2023 now, and so I think it's starting to maybe shift back in the other directions, but I think Zoom is, of course, one of the biggest ways that suddenly we could all attend readings and bookstore events, and people who could not physically make it to a bookstore suddenly were on a level playing field, at least with those kinds of access. And it's interesting when, you know, a lot of big conferences for years would not allow panelists to Zoom in, even when they were not physically able to be at a conference for immunocompromised health status or any number of other disabilities. And suddenly with the pandemic, we realized, oh wait, this would benefit everybody.
Right.
And that's what happens so many times with these kinds of technologies, I'll say, but also just behavior and acceptance and perspectives. When the larger mainstream culture can benefit from it, then it's going to trickle down to the disability community. And I hope that maintains. We are still seeing a lot of virtual bookstore events because authors and publishers don't have the money to send writers on tour. And so on a physical tour. And so, and conferences are maintaining the ability or the option for panelists to be there virtually. Audiobooks used to be denigrated as this inferior form of reading. Enter the iPhone, enter apps that allowed people to read with their ears in a way that was extremely convenient and engaging, and podcasts sort of helped pave the way for people wanting content in their ears. And now audiobooks continue to be the fastest growing, maybe the only growing in many years, element of the publishing sales industry. And I, of course, read with my ears exclusively from age 16 on, and right, always felt ashamed from it because you encounter jokes in popular culture and you encounter, like, oh, it's just listening, it's not reading. Mm-hmm. And we've come so far with that debate. And some of it is the studies that show there's no significant difference between reading with your ears and reading with your eyes. Are there differences? Yes, but not really distinctions. It's just some people are better at one than the other. But most people don't care about those studies. The average person who reads an audiobook just cares that it's more accessible for them in right, their schedule, more accessible for them in the ways they're able to read books. And when accessibility is something that makes life easier for a non-disabled person, suddenly the disability community is finally going to benefit from that. I'm encountering people now who don't, even as they still say listened instead of read, right, as an almost apologetic way of framing how they engage with a book. You know, that distinction, it still bothers me because it makes us think that we have to distinguish, like there is a right way and a wrong way to consume or engage with a book.
As though the original stories were not
exactly
told with our bodies and meant to be listened to,
right,
you know.
I mean, publishing in the grand scheme of things is so young. The question that I keep coming back to with ableism is, and with accessibility, is people who don't want us to have access or people who don't want to acknowledge audiobooks as reading, what are they hoping to gain from that distinction or that prevention? Clearly, one side, the marginalized side, is losing, and the other side is quote-unquote winning. But what are they winning other than a sense of exclusion and superiority? And the superiority is really just an illusion or a locked door.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point. And something I think about a lot from our conversation for WNC was Leona's story about narrating her audiobook and having the director require that she use the term listener instead of reader during the parts where she's addressing the reader. And I'm curious about so many things, but I'm curious about like your decision not to narrate your audiobook, how you came to that decision. And I know you were very happy with the selection of the person who ultimately did so.
I'll be honest and say up front that I did feel an obligation to audition for the role of myself narrating the audiobook. But I was not looking forward, especially in the pandemic when a lot of auxiliary studios were going to be closed, of possibly having to go to a big city like Charlotte or Raleigh and maybe spend a night or two. But the way I read is the way Leona narrated Their Plant Eyes, which is an earbud in your ears with either a screen reader or your own pre-recorded voice, and then narrating just a quarter second or half second behind the voice in your ears. So I didn't get the job narrating my own audiobook, and the disappointment was exceedingly brief. They told me that they thought a professional narrator could really bring out the emotion and humor in the work more than me. And I could not have agreed more. And but my immediate thought was, oh, this is going to be awesome. I actually will be able to read my book in the way that I have always read books. You know, I can hold a print book in my hand. I can hold a magnifier up and see parts of it. But a physical book to me has always been this fraught and not entirely meaningful object. It is more of an object than a book. And the possibility that I might be able to consume my own work in the way that I have consumed all other books since age 16 was really exciting. And then in that same email where they said, you did not get the part, I said, well, I'm just going to go for it here and tell them what I do want in a narrator. And I look forward to them sending me a choice of two or three narrators and maybe having written an audiobooks column recommending audiobooks for a couple of years at this point. For Lit Hub, I might possibly even know the names or voices of some of these people. And I said, I would love somebody like Curtis Armstrong, who did the narration for a book called Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 1980s Changed Hollywood Forever. And I remembered that audiobook so well, which for nonfiction, usually the best you can hope for in a narrator is that they just sort of are like water, that you don't notice them, that they are just a completely translucent barrier between you and the text. But in this book about movies and actors full of so much humor and so many stories and a lot of pathos as well, Curtis Armstrong, whose voice I recognized right away, and I said, is that, oh my God, that's Curtis Armstrong from Revenge of the Nerds and Risky Business and One Crazy Summer, all of which I watched so many times when I was a kid. So I remember thinking how much emotion and just wisdom he infused every sentence with. It was like he knew exactly how to deliver every single sentence. And it wasn't acting, it was just inhabiting the text. So I said, I would love somebody like Curtis Armstrong. He did great work on this. And I thought he was really able to capture the humor and emotion of a book that I wouldn't necessarily think of as one containing a ton of humor and emotion. So I think it was about a month and a half later, hadn't heard anything, and I got an email back from our go-between, from the audiobook publisher and Norton, forwarding me the message saying, you can't announce this yet, but we were able to get Curtis. To this day, that possibly remains the coolest thing about my book. If not, it's in at least a three-way tie. When I read my audiobook, which I have done multiple times, not because I'm a narcissist, but because I'm just so pleased with how it came out and because I'm interested in Curtis's take on it, it just feels a little bit otherworldly. Like I imagine a lot of people feel who have their books turned into movies. I don't know if this is the closest I'll come to that, but if so, it's quite lovely.
Yeah. I read your book with my ears, and I thought he did such a wonderful job, especially at the parts that were the most emotional, that were the most angry, that were the saddest. You know, he really embodied all of that. And I'm curious if you had any personal interaction with him about,
you know,
about this.
Kind of. We've communicated on Twitter, and he knows how happy I was. He could not be a sweeter or a more generous person. We did do a joint interview totally separately, but it was like Hal Booger from Revenge of the Nerds came to narrate a Greensboro author's audiobook.
I love it. And, you know, you've mentioned Twitter, you've mentioned social media. As you are well aware, I deeply admire your Twitter game, even in these dark times for that particular
platform.
When
the game is being destroyed.
I'm curious about your relationship to social media, and especially, you know, I think a lot about how among the many arcs that are in Blind Man's Bluff, one of them is this movement from isolation to community and acceptance, self-acceptance, but also from other folks. And I'm curious about what social media has opened up for you in terms of community with other blind and low vision folks.
I hope Twitter continues to be a space where we're writing a little bit apart from the weird political Twitter and the oddities that have occurred since the platform was sold to he who shall not be named. But the way that Twitter and to a lesser extent Facebook have flattened the earth for people who have maybe had trouble making community either through geographic limitations or accessibility limitations. Honestly, people who have become my first readers now, I have met through Twitter. I have either me being fans of their work or they reaching out as a fan of my work. And so it's just this lovely thing. And I finally get to meet some of them in person, like at AWP. And it's like, oh, wow, you do exist off Twitter. And everybody, without fail, has been even lovelier in person than they've been on Twitter or Facebook. Mm. And then the second part of that is making yourself publicly identifiable as blind or disabled, and then engaging with this other specific community has been something that I really wished I had had in the 1990s. I mean, would I have been brave enough? Would I have been secure enough to have done so? I don't know, but to have had that option, I think, would have pushed me in the direction of self-acceptance sooner. There is, for example, on Facebook, after news of my book started trickling out with pre-order pages or press releases or stuff like that, my condition, Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, which is not a succinct phrase and is not something that people are readily aware of.
Right.
So I suspect people for whom that is an important topic for research development or so on have probably set up Google Alerts. And so I'm assuming that's how somebody on Facebook who runs an LHON community found me and messaged me and congratulated me on the book and asked if I wanted to join that community. And it's sort of half people who have LHON and half parents and family of people who have LHON. And I remember when I was first diagnosed, you know, in 1993, my mom was on the phone for hours at a time with somebody that just my diagnosing doctor had put her in touch with. And that was how community was formed before the internet. As, you know, one random person says, yes, I would like to be in touch with this parent so we can, you know, problem solve, but also maybe unpack the emotions of being the parent of somebody who's lost their sight, and that there's this entire giant forum of thousands of people now. I think there's different LHON groups on Facebook for different regions of the U.S., to say nothing of the rest of the world. So, I mean, you have these developments in research that are topics, but people just sharing, hey, my son is doing blind golf. Mm-hmm. Here's what that is, if anybody's interested in finding out more. You know, the world feels so much bigger in a good way, thanks to social media.
In thinking about community, you know, we're doing this interview for an issue of NCLR that's about disability in North Carolina literature. Uh-huh. And I'm curious about, you know, other disabled creatives, specifically those from the blind and low vision community, who are doing things that really excite you, whether in North Carolina or beyond.
Yeah, I should give a shout out to the winner of the Creative Nonfiction Prize, Laura Hopegill, who has written the most amazing essay about her own unique disabilities and the ways they have changed the way she has to engage with the world visually as mm-hmm. well as creatively. A writer whose book comes out 2 days from today that I'm extremely excited about, Andrew Leland. Mm-hmm. It's a book called Country of the Blind. He has, I believe, retinitis pigmentosa, and so he learned at a young age that he would eventually go blind. Mm. And so it's been a decades-long countdown in which he's prepared for this, but also engaged with the world in a very thorough and curious way, and sort of giving the world a sort of Anthony Bourdain-like tour guide experience of the blind experience that awaits him not too far from now. Another essay collection was Chloe Cooper Jones' Easy Beauty, which was actually a finalist for the memoir category in the Pulitzers in the spring. And it's a brilliant book, and Chloe's voice is one that I think we'll be turning to and hearing from and reading for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I will also give a shout out to Greg Marshall, whose memoir called Leg just came out. It's about his experience of missing a leg and feeling so deeply ashamed about this element of his identity for so many years. And it's, I trust, an exceedingly smart but also a really moving and funny journey. He's somebody who is gay and writes about the intersection of disability and queerness.
You know, another question as we work toward the close, you know, we're having this conversation during Disability Pride Month. And, you know, I know that for a long time you resisted using the word blind or disabled mm-hmm. to describe your experience using, you know, work around, finding ways around those terms. And I'm curious about what disability pride and blind pride means to you at this point and during this month when that's something we're celebrating.
Yeah, that's something that takes me back to your question about finding your community mm-hmm. and finding your people. And when I was first coming to terms with the diagnosis and then to the experience of living with blindness, it didn't occur to me that there would be a community, and certainly not one that I would want to be a part of. And Leona's book came out 2 months before mine, and so we found each other months before our books came out and sort of shared in that process. And I was just so proud, like a sibling would be, whenever her book got attention, and she was very supportive of my book. We got to do a lot of events together. And that to me is what disability pride is like, you're not reaching out to commiserate, you're reaching out to celebrate.
Yes.
And that you are engaging with people who inhabit the world in a similar way and have a point of view that's similar to you. And, you know, it's not unlike being from a small state or a small town. It's like when you find each other and share this experience, it's like this virtual fist bump of, yeah, I know what that's like. Mm. And it's not miserable, it's kind of cool, you know, that it's not a bug, but a feature. And but also the coolness of being able to reach out to somebody of like, hey, I'm going to travel and I think I'm going to buy a cane for the first time, just as a signal that somebody I'm asking for directions might actually give them to me in a meaningful way.
Right.
And how big should it be? That to me is the greatest element of disability pride. And I imagine, you know, regular Pride Month of June is not unlike that, of people reaching out to each other and say, yes, I understand this experience, which is a wonderful experience, but also being able to support one another in those meaningful ways when being part of this smaller, marginalized community can be fraught.
You know, as a queer person, like something that I think about a lot is this like tragic queer narrative that is so often expected of us. And I think there's certainly a parallel with this idea of the inspiring story of disability, liberal air quotes here, you know.
Yeah, I, you know, and before I learned very early on not to go to Goodreads, I encountered a couple of people disappointed by the end of Blind Man's Bluff because they did not understand that self-acceptance could manifest in different ways.
Right.
They thought the only rightful ending of this journey of self-acceptance would be me seeking out a guide dog or me seeking out a cane and standing in the town square hoisting the cane in the air and some grand celebratory song and dance. But as Leona says, there are as many ways of being blind as there are being sighted.
Absolutely.
And there are as many experiences of disability as there are of being able-bodied. And there is no one-size-fits-all narrative. There is no one-size-fits-all disability narrative. And I think that's when we'll have full acceptance. And you can say this for African-Americans, for the LGBTQ community, and any marginalized group. We're going to have full acceptance when the breadth of those stories and voices and experiences get to be told, and that we can't just have this one type of journey or one type of happy ending be the one-size-fits-all that the mainstream culture accepts.
Audrey Jennifer Smith, she, they, received a master's degree in secondary English language arts education from UNC Greensboro and an MFA degree from Oregon State University. She is a bookseller for Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. Their creative writing has been featured in Hippocampus Magazine, among others. Audrey was named winner of the 2022 Alex Albright Creative Nonfiction Prize for their excerpt In the Summer of Missing Girls, which appeared in NCLR 2023.